from that we can see now why they gave this technique as a means to burn it up in one incarnation, instead of having to go through many, many incarnations. If you apply yourself in one incarnation, you can resolve all those misapplied decisions and move into the Delta level or the cosmic state. So it's not something nebulous or way off in some remote region. And just today was an interesting incident. Remember last night what we spoke about? Good. I'm going to let my friend David tell you what we ran into today at this beautiful place where we went.
Last night he was talking about incorruptibility, the bodies of saints that weren't decomposed and so forth. We went out to the White Dove of the Desert, San Javier. Mm-hmm. Okay, and we were there last time Adana was here, and there's a little monk out there that shuffles, and shuffles, lights the candles, shuffles. And we were really drawn to him last time we were there. Just there was a synchronistic feeling about him. Well, here he was again, church full of tourists, shuffling, lighting the candles. Then he looks at Adano, stands back, and with great authority, starts talking about the incorrupt body of San Javier. And went into extreme detail about the scientific proof of all these things.
It was so appropriate. And then he quotes the different documents that you could go find in that. And he's looking straight at me, you know. Oh, it was beautiful how it came out.
That's neat.
And he's saying it's all evidential science. Mm-hmm. So and the people are listening, but they're turning by. He's looking directly. It was beautifully timed, you see, mm-hmm. of what you were talking. But he spoke with such authority, that was so mm-hmm. beautiful, you know, mm-hmm. you can see the man and hear him talk.
Mm-hmm. Adana, when a master takes on a student's karma by through illness or whatever, is that old or new karma being burned?
That's a shunt off, he doesn't take on your karma. We assume that the person is taking it but not valid. Let me give you an example. Let's say your car broke down and there's no one to help you, and along comes somebody to give you a hand. Is that taking on your karma to help you back get your tire in, or take you down to the garage with your tire and get it fixed and bring you back? You couldn't say he's taking on your karma.
There'd have to be an exchange of parts,
wouldn't there? The need of your nature to have your car moving, and he, another person coming along and seeing you there, could either stop and give you a helping hand. Mm-hmm. Now, some people may stop or may not stop depending on their time and their fears. But the person that does stop is the one that your thought for your need is synchronized, and that person is acting as a shunt to help you get through that particular state of embarrassment. And so he may take you down the road with the flat tire, get it to the gas station, you can get it fixed, and he will help to drive you back early. So he is not taking on your karma. But he is what you would say a form of compensatory function. The guru is more like a nursemaid that you hire to take care of your children when you're not at home. So that's the role they are in. They're not taking on. The nursemaid doesn't take on the child's anguish or frustration. It's there to see that the parent role is fulfilled through them. So a realized master is one who has realized his intimacy with God, and that intimacy first comes by cleaning up his own act. So by and large, he has nothing more to offer you than a cleanup process from body, mind, and spirit. In whatever level you find yourself locked into a feedback of your incorrect decisions, he's offering you a way to get out of it. But he can't take it on. That's why he'll tell you, pick up your own cross and follow me. He can't pick up his cross. So how could he be taking away your sins? He can say, your sins are forgiven you, meaning as of now, you are not incurring any future misapplied decisions from this moment of initiation, and I'm offering you a method to resolve what you have done to this moment. And when you resolve it, keep using the method, therefore you wouldn't want to be accumulating anymore. Do you see?
What?
But you first got to resolve, you first have to be given the key to resolve, and what you resolve after it's cancelled out or resolved, that same key would prevent you from accumulating. But you can't go any other route than that route, because that's where they say, suffer to be so, for this is the way, right? No man come unto the Father but by the initiatory process is the only rational route that the passenger can be given a key to drive the car or get behind the wheel. And let's say you're in a jeopardy by being a passenger, you got to go someplace and nobody wants to take you, but somebody loans you their car and you say you know to drive, okay, you can go take care of your problems then, but you have to return the car. So sooner or later you're going to have to decide in your mind, do you want to own a car or not? Then that will free you from what? Being in that jeopardy state and start driving your own car. That's the same way with initiation. Initiation is a specific way to phase off the previous conditions of misapplied decisions and retain a process to prevent the accumulation. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a valid system. If you're only going to phase off what is in the past and then accumulate more, what good is the initiation? The initiation must be a means of phasing off what you have done prior to initiation without anyone becoming interested to give you something to phase it out. Otherwise, in the traditional way of their nature, let's say a person came along to initiate you, showing you already you have 1,000 misapplied decisions, you only resolve 40 in your first incarnation. You got 960. You know how many will keep piling up? Well, that will just keep piling up. So there's no way to resolve it. But the moment someone comes along and gives you a technique, which is an initiation now, okay, you got 50 left. Here, this technique will resolve the 50, but at the same time, this technique will prevent you from accumulating more. So therefore, you can come into your true nature. And that's the whole idea behind it. But many of these teachers don't talk that way because they don't have that time to talk. They're too busy, what, going around cleaning up their spiritual runny noses. So, but in getting together like this and working through your own personal experiences in the meditation and resolving, then you can, the questions comes up, what you are doing and how you are resolving it.
And each breath dissolves, did you say one?
No. One registration, which is equal to 3 breaths. That is one inhalation, one exhalation, one inhalation. It's the mid one is the registration. So if you breathe in 3 times, one in, one out, one in, you get one registration. Not just one breath in is a registration. Because the first breath and the last breath does not register on the endocrine system, and it doesn't register on the helix of the DNAs and RNAs. It's the middle one. It's like the cheese between the bread. You see, that's what makes a sandwich. The bread is the two outside part, but the inside is the thing that... So the middle portion of the respiratory function is the cleansing principle. That portion of oxygenation is the cleansing action of the DNAs, the RNAs, and the endocrine gland system, where the residual sonics are stored in the mechanism from the misapplied decisions made by the mouth and the enzymic action in the body in one physical incarnation, not all being resolved and carried on in the electrical field, because you can't get rid of them in the electrical field, to the next chemical body to continue to be resolved. So you have your unfinished debt, which you're committed to resolve it, and therefore common sense will tell you it will take too many incarnations to resolve it if no one ever intercedes to give you a method to phase it out. In other words, that would be, you'll be going spiritually bankrupt. You see what I mean? You're accumulating too big a deficit to cope with your energy. So realize men come back as spiritual nursemaids more or less to give you a way to resolve it, and then from then on you don't accumulate it. Mm-hmm. See, that's why they say your sins are forgiven thee, meaning you're not going to generate action that accumulates, but you will be generating action to resolve what has been accumulated. You get a fresh start back in your own consciousness. So that is why initiation is set up as the right way back to the creative intelligence. But then you look at things externally, you see the same phenomena going on. So you can't have something external that is not already going on internally. The laws are very exact. That's why Jesus would say, none come unto the Father but by me. It's not me, the man Jesus, but me, the principle of initiation that is passing through Jesus to those who come to that process. And it has to be at the living level. We cannot be initiated from a dead level. It's not a valid initiation. If a guru has passed on, he doesn't initiate. He may come into your life and may exercise his power to help you with some dilemma, but he will not initiate you. A living representative of his, or anyone following in his path, would be the one who would initiate you. You can't ask a dead dentist to take your teeth out, but you sure can ask as a student who has learned his dentistry to do it for you. See what I mean? The same principle is there. The dead dentist may be there to look at you at night and see if your teeth are being well, but he certainly can't work on it. So, but he can guide the student, he can be the guidance to his own student by giving him intuitive glimpses of how to handle the case and work with it. So that's why they say all the angels are behind the realized man, and all the angelic forces, the only ones are there to see that focal point work. But they're not going to do it. So the Catholic Church is saying, now if you get a healing from a saint, if he's dead, then that intercession would be valid, and it defies every explanation, and not before he's dead, because before he's dead and you're healed by him, it can always be some form of hypnosis. If he's dead, he's not intervening in any hypnotic way in your life. He's actually working from the full incorruptible body to resolve your problem that is assumed to be out of the range of rational control. Therefore, he's intervening at that other level to phase down the breakdown in the body. But he's not initiating you. He's not giving you no special way to resolve your problems. He will resolve a problem for you if you ask him. So you have a bad knee that can't be healed, and the doctors have tried every possible way, but instead of you go and pray to a realized person who has passed on for a healing, and the healing occurs and it defies every medical process, you know he has intervened. But he's not going to give you no method to stop you from making mistakes. You see what I mean? Now the living teacher who would be living would then give you a process of how to correct the other mistakes that aren't resolved, and at the same time the method would prevent you from accumulating future problems. And that's valid, you see. So that's why the Jesus make the statement, none come unto me but by the Father, but none come unto the Father but by me, meaning you have to meet the initiation at the living level. You have an example between John the Baptist and Jesus at the garden at the River Jordan. That's actually initiation baptism in the olden days of the word. John claimed he baptizes by water. That was his method of initiating the person through water to phase down previous acquired karmic conditions or misapplied decisions. But he was doing it utterly as long as you came up and accept him to put the water in your head. Fine, all that you've done in the past is resolved. Now, but he's saying at the same time, I baptize by water, but there cometh one who baptized by the Spirit. Meaning that he's not going to use no outward symbol to resolve this condition, but at the same time, he's going to leave you a way that you won't accumulate any future conditions. John's method is, you resolve the past, but I don't guarantee you're not going to go back and do the same thing, you see? And that's what John's says. So he's telling them, I got one way, is to clean up your house, but I got no guarantee you're going to go and muck it up again. Now, the other fellow is coming, and he will clean up your house, but he's giving you something that you don't muck it up. So when he comes, and so when he shows up, the two men are recognizing each other. One is recognizing that he's capable of phasing down past actions, but not initiating or leaving any condition that would prevent you from acquiring new ones. And the other one is already coming with both to phase it down and prevent you from accumulating. So the recognition of that is between the student and the teacher. Jesus walks up and says, there is no man born of woman greater than John, who is Elijah that has come. Well, the church has tried to remove that so long, to this day that stopped, because that is an outright declaration of a past life association. There's no way you can get around the implication. So they don't bother to make an issue of it. But he says, baptize me. And John says, no, you baptize me. Then picture for one moment two grown fellows arguing who should throw water at each other's head. But it goes deeper than that. That the living relationship of phasing down the past activities was valid for John to perform, but not to give to the future any means of preventing it from recurring. And John realized that, so he didn't want to assume or usurp that position, because that was not his role. Jesus wanted him to initiate him just the same, because he realized that this was his teacher from a past life, and he was a student, and he's paid respect to his alma mater of that particular tradition. So, suffer it to be so. This is the way of righteousness, the statement he backed it up with when he asked for the baptism. Then John refused. In other words, put up with it. I know you don't have the right to prevent the future karma, but nevertheless, I have to get started. You got to turn me loose and give me the credence that I can go out now and set up this process. So John goes ahead and he baptizes him. But it's John who sees in his own consciousness the phenomena. And here's this declaration. This is my beloved son in whom I'm well pleased. And he saw the dove. It's his own God nature now who has become resolved as Elijah living in John, which is the God nature, and seeing the disciple coming of age to assume the true responsibility of being a channel for handing them knowledge that would resolve past life karmic debt and prevent futuristic accumulation of debts by, see. So he's pleased now that he was able to put it in proper context and be the alma mater representation to let it go and have validity into the world of the living. Which then takes us now, as we come into the process and start resolving our karma, the older we are or the younger we are, whenever we come to it, that's tells us there's a minimal and a maximal if you come into initiation when you're old, you have a maximal amount to resolve. When you come into initiation when you're young, you have a minimal amount to resolve. Because the intensity of the craving to resolve it would be in the previous lives running up to that point. And therefore, you would have the technique of phasing it down, and at the same time, the technique would help you from accumulating more. See, it's one technique that does both. It phases off what has been done, and now inhibits the accumulation of more. And your age craving would be the quantum craving. Just as much as when you meet a young person who talks to you first, versus an old person who talks to you first. The old person who talks to you first is past life, karmic, unfinished conditions. Therefore, they are trying to exercise their authority in that karmic pattern to you. But if it's a young person confronting you, that's a spermal confrontation, where the sperm that you left behind when you went to the ovum to be born a winner, you had to leave a whole pile of them behind, so they had to phase out. They didn't make it. They're going to have to make it in another time, but they'll be younger than you. And what are they coming to confront you is, that did you tell Daddy off for us? Why you threw us out without asking our consent? That's what all the sperms are saying when they get thrown out the very first time out of the father to go move to the ovum, because they're thrown in a quandary and they don't have any logic or rhyme or reason why they're out. So it's a race of survival. One has got to win. Although I'm not talking of pins or triplets, I'm talking of one race. So the rest that are going to phase out, they're phasing out without any rational reason for phasing out, and not any rational compensation for being thrown out without their consent. So the only thing they can ask is the winner, well, if you tell them that for us, you're the winner, we can't help it. So now, but that unfinished resolve feeling is going to be in that life form, to pick up again and come on into a new body form for that particular condition. So you may walk in a room, and I had this happen to me not too long ago. I walk into a Chinese restaurant, grocery store, and I'm standing there with my friend Ed and Melissa. And this little boy, he's about 8 years of age, he's walking through. He's looking at everybody, and he comes looking at,
are you?
There are nationality in the place, men and women, and he walks right up to me, and I'm laughing to myself, here comes formal confrontation. And he says, no. He says, are you from Hong Kong? No. He says, you come to buy? He says, yes. He says, this is my father's store. He's over there by the cash box. This is mother. She's doing all the other alignments in the shop. And I'm here to see no one take anything.
Great.
I said, how old are you? He says, 8 years old. And he's walking around, and it was comical how he confronted me, of all the people in the room, on a spermal level confrontation, straight language. And I'm laughing at the whole thing. You see, he really was asking me in his mind, I could feel it in his eyes, did you tell Daddy off? Because he says, this father's over there, you know. Somehow, the relation was. But that's what a spermal confrontation is, when a young person walk right up to you and openly start a conversation.
I don't know, is it what we're talking about now, the same thing as the original sin in the previous life accumulation?
Yeah.
Is that what the Catholic Church
is? That's what the Catholic Church
is. So the baptism resolves
that. It's resolved that. The initiation resolves that. That's what it's for in the first place.
Grossly misinterpreted.
You see, when Jesus came, he had to start somewhere in the agricultural language, knowing fully well the agricultural language had to go through a process of evolution to a comprehensive level where man would assume his own responsibility to take care of it. But in the meantime, it had to go by way of the agricultural knowledge evolving to where we can confront it without guilt or being threatened by the process of releasing it. And so centuries ago, man could not do that because he wasn't ready. A child isn't ready to assume responsibility because he doesn't have logic. So the agricultural language is an asset of preparing them to assume responsibility. But we're phasing out of the agricultural heritage and getting more into technical society. And you can see in a few more years, the child isn't what he used to be in the last 60 years. Every 2-year-old kid is monkeying around with a computer already. So he's way into another dimension of thinking. And so, though he may be impractical at the time, but his sense of logic is the period between the impractical to logic level of the child is diminishing. So let's say a child in the last 40 years from the day it was born to what we call the logical level would be 12. Then it started to become logical after 12 to rationalize and relate. From now to the year 2000, the next 14 years, the logical level is starting to show up at 9 or 10. They're becoming, because a lot of the young kids who are capable of doing a lot of the logical calculations are falling into age 9. So therefore, that gap is a vast reduction.
We saw a 13-year-old on Johnny Carson last night, who's at the University of Illinois, taking advanced mathematics courses and plays the violin like nothing you've ever heard.
So you see the intellectual span is reducing, the period between is reducing. So this is not going to be one rare instant, it's going to be more and more. See, because those individuals are not living in an agricultural heritage anymore, they're living in the technical heritage. And you can picture one moment when he completes his educational level and becomes professional, his children is going to be in the 1-to-9 ratio of intellectual capability because they're transferring them.
And now is it true they're coming back from the Atlantean age?
Yes, all your past, remember, we don't reincarnate for anything other than to work out the misapplied decisions that in ancient days man called sin. Eastern man didn't want to use those words, so they developed the word karma. And scientific men could not cope with the word karma too much, so he developed the word cause and effect. So as we get more and more specific in the language, we can't break the law, or all we can do is rephrase the terminology to the law. The law is the actual experiment. So Yogananda would say this, when the theory or the description of the experiment as the actual application are in conflict with each other in terms of carrying it on or communicating, it is better to throw away the theory and keep the experiment, because you can always invent a new way to say it. But the same experiment is being done over and over, and everybody will do it till they're satisfied. But each person can have his own way of describing it to himself. So that's valid. For that reason, they say truth is one, paths are many, or there are many ways to say the thing. But what we're really looking at in terms of evolution is we're looking at the agricultural heritage into a technological heritage of the very same laws of nature that we live by, but how we talk to ourselves, which of the two language procedure has the least or the most guilt. See, a human being can't really function with the most guilt in his life. You break down. He can function with the least guilt. So if you're going to make a decision involving your existence, you usually end up making decisions that involve the least guilt. You never involve yourself with the most guilt. It'll break you down. So that, but then it's your language of describing the function to yourself that may either have the feeling of the most or least guilt. Now, what you're trying to evolve into is language that doesn't generate guilt, but generate responsibility. Because then this is health, instead of living to die, as I said last night. And then this gentleman today at the church is talking about the role of the incorruptible and no breakdown of the body. And it's not a figment of imagination, it's very scientific. He's gone on to, he himself, he's in his 90s, I think, is it? And he's talking of looking at a thing scientifically. So we are at that level, we're in the transformation level of benefiting from these men that have gone ahead. Now how to apply it in a day-to-day living. See, it's all right, I don't say God cannot intervene in periodical cases by devout action, but then this is not really giving man the freedom to realize God. It is restricting man. When man is breaking away from the restriction and assuming the responsibility to be free from what is truly factual about himself, then there's a faster unfoldment of the human race. And we are moving to that. Because we are recognizing what we are saying to ourselves, and it doesn't have to do with age anymore. That again is fading out. It has to do with how many revolutions you're around the sun. Mm-hmm. So this is what gives you your health back. And I don't think that man would ever say he's 90 years of age either. Because the way he spoke very scientific, one who never spoke much with him. It was very thrilling to see him talk that way. No one, I don't think anyone expected him to talk that way. But he sure did.
What's the next level? Spiritual? From technological?
Yes, let me put it this way. There are three tests that are being used to define the evolution of the individual from the basic level to the highest level of realization. Test one is how spiritual the person is. In order to test that person is to see if this person can fulfill the practicality of moment-to-moment living. That would determine how spiritual the person is, not how religious the person is. So if a person says he's pursuing a certain religious path and would adhere to it, the only way to test that religious path, if it will fulfill its true obligation, is how practical that person is with his spiritual belief moment to moment. That's a measuring stick, like a state exam. So spirituality is measured by the human effort to be practical moment to moment. That's the first test. So if you leave the churchianistic thinking of your holy than thou attitude and start to be more practical involvement, which would be the least you have done unto one of these, you've done it unto me. That's the spiritualistic approach. So it's every little aspect of life being meaningful for the first time. It's not just some nebulous region. It's in here now, in the present time, and in a practical sense. Not impractical, not fanatical. This is the first breakthrough or transformation of the religious mind into a spiritual mind. Now the religious mind can be fanatical and take tremendous chances thinking God's going to save it when he may send him two boats and a helicopter. But a spiritual mind will not do that. A spiritual mind will get on board of the boat and go on up and continue to serve the congregation. So this is what we say in the spiritual mind, the practical issue of the moment. That's the test. Now the second test is the person's divinity, if they are truly in a state of divine order. That is, how immune they are to the breakdown of the illnesses around them, how their body withstands the imposition of nature's conditions to break it down. So immunity would be the second test. The first test is practicality of the moment. The second test would be immunity to the diseases around in the environmental field, because the body of a realized person can withstand all the symptoms of disease that would kill the average person, and they would have it and still don't show any signs of breaking down. That is the degree of their immunity to the dedication. So if we have two tests already, one for spirituality and one for divinity, we know that spirituality is being practical and divinity is being immune. Now the last test is the enlightenment. How enlightened or how free man or lord of yourself. The test of that is the ability to act the moment. Whenever you're called upon to act, it's command performance. If you're truly enlightened, you don't have a if or a but or a maybe. You act immediately, because you can take full responsibility for the action. The liberated person or the enlightened person is one who can act on command performance without any fear of repercussions from his words, because he's already initiated not to create or accumulate what any futuristic residual backwash of his thinking. So he is totally free, because he's resolved his past incorrect decisions, he hasn't accumulated any, so he's clear. So when called upon to act by creative intelligence or any form, it's an automatic response, and it goes, and it's selfless. So we say the selfless service, or seva, which is the word they use, is the liberated person. By the command performance to act, they are free and liberated. So they can assume the role of being a cosmic nurse maid for other unenlightened beings, because they don't have anything to hold them back or feel trapped by. They've already resolved all the conditions that the unenlightened being hasn't resolved. So, but they, because they're free to help the unenlightened is going to crave evidence, because they don't know what it is they're trying to overcome. And the evidence that they'll crave is the spirituality, the evidence of being practical, because they may be so impractical and caught up in their fanatical behavior, and they're going to crave immunity, because they may be so broken up by their own misapplied decisions that's causing the body to give them diseases of all types. So the liberated man, totally free without any backwash, can demonstrate by his own living existence the practicalness and the immunity of the reality of spirit. Free man or Lord of Self. Now you can look at it in another aspect, take it out of the churchianistic concept, Clark Kent behind a telephone booth becoming Superman to take care of the world's calamities. See the same thing? Or Lone Ranger. Any of these heroic figures who step out from behind the cloud of fixed ignorant thinking to resolve dilemma. And that is looking at it as another aspect. If we don't want to look at it in a churchianistic tone, a liberated person steps out from his fixations to serve life. So this is basically valid.
I have a question. Using the Lone Ranger, does a liberated man use a mask also?
The liberated man doesn't have any need for outward promotion or being made a public figure. His very action, wherever he is serving. He may get the notoriety from others who want to build him up, but he doesn't look for it.
So his selfless service is his mask.
What is his true mask is to do something without mentioning it. Mm-hmm. That's the true mask. Mm-hmm. That you don't even know he did it. That's why there are more saints, now put it this way, there are more saints living in seclusion, solving the problems of many of the beings on the planet without the beings themselves knowing they're being helped by them, versus the few that we hear about and we pray for. And I got this done to me one time. I had a problem, and I knew Yogananda, Lahiri, and all the masters, right? So normally what would I do? I would pray to the people I know to resolve my problem. Well, I kept on praying. I thought the problem was resolved by them. To my own surprise, there was a man called Sai Baba, who I never even heard of, resolving my problem. And I saw Sai Baba, who is he? I never heard of him. And my problem is resolved, and I'm getting the image, and I ask him, who are you? I don't know you. And then the word comes in, Sai Baba. Then it was a year after, I'm in California, and somebody is coming in with some pictures. And I said, Adana, I got this picture a year ago, and I've been carrying it around. I was in India at an ashram, and somewhere, I don't know, you call it Patapuri or Pandapuri or something like that, but I kept this picture, and I want to give it to you. I know it's for you. I don't know why. And I said, there's a little package of powder. And I said, oh. And I said, oh, who is your name? The man? Well, I don't know if you ever heard of him, but he's called Sai Baba. I said, and he got powder for me? Mm-hmm. He said, yeah, he says, this is what he calls Babuti. I said, thank you. And I look at it and I start laughing. And the fellow looked at me and said, why are you laughing? What's so funny? I said, if I told you that I'd been healed by this man, I didn't even know his name, and I was too busy praying to Yogananda, and I heard not the rest, and they were to do the doggone thing for me. So I said, it taught me that it's not always who you pray to has the option to serve you. Maybe the karma that I was trying to resolve with somebody else. So I realized that many other great masters are living to resolve the different types of karmic debt, that we have to have a universal brotherhood in consciousness. I said, you may also have gone through some of that experience. Yeah, he said, I couldn't understand it either. He said, I used to pray to Sri Yukteswar with help, and when it didn't come true, some remote Indian man would get help, and then I'd go traveling through India, and I'd be at the ashram, and somebody said, Swamiji wants to talk to you. Oh, but I have never met Swamiji. He says, he knows you. He never met him, and the person is telling him he knows him. So when they meet, he says, hello, Swamiji. He said, isn't your name Robert? He says, yes. He says, well, how you knew Swamiji? He says, you remember such and such a time? But that was in America. He said, yeah, you prayed to Sri Yukteswar, but it's my turn to help you. Yukteswar is already gone, see? But this is the thing, that the other masters are working to carry on, because they have the living body, to give us assurance that we are not left to ourselves. That's the beautiful part of the initiate, more than the non-initiate. The non-initiate can never really appreciate the fact that there are other beings interested in his life. It's the initiate who becomes aware, appreciative, to know that he once got on the path, and the person who he is relating to may not be always the one person who is resolving his problems, but there are other individuals who are assigned like a brotherhood to take care of the brother. In other words, if you join the Masons, they're going to take care of you because you're a Mason. They're not going to take care of you outside of the Masonry, right? Mm-hmm. The same principle. Initiates automatically have a conclave or a brotherhood ready to pour upon them their spiritual knowledge. The others don't have, because no master will intervene in your life or interfere with you. But when you make the attempt to be an initiate, that means you want to assume the responsibility of your life, to get behind the wheel. Then they're willing to take and give you all the directions to make it, but it will not take away your experience. But they're there, and you will find that who you least expect in that conclave is doing the thing. So that's the great assurance of it, that once you become an initiate, all the masters are working with you. That when you're not a non-initiate, you see, you're at a handicap with you. That doesn't say good prayer and wishing and going to church, that the minister can't invoke God's love to intercede. But it's not the way of righteousness. It is mostly the something for nothing attitude still. It's still the child and the nursemaid I'm still a type of a passenger. But you want to be in a position where you can be the driver behind the wheel and have a brotherhood of people who respect you for that and give you their love and their abundance to help you work through the control of your own lifestyle. That's more of it. That's what they call white brotherhood.
What's the third level? I missed the third level.
Third level? The ability to act on command performance. Supposing someone comes at you, would you do this for me? And if you don't have no ifs, but maybes in your mental thinking, because you resolve all your anguish, you get up and act right away. But if you haven't resolved it, you're questioned. Mm-hmm. So then that's not liberated. The liberated person doesn't question any request, because he understands the request is divine will. Not my will, but thy will be done. Jesus was asked to go through crucifixion. But then, what did he say? Not my will, but thy will be done. And went through it. So this is what freedom really is. So once you can come to that, then you pass the three tests of spirituality, divinity, and enlightenment. The spirituality is being practical moment to moment. Divinity is being immune and freed, or enlightened means to act on command performance. These are the ways you test it. So when a person is immune, you know how divine their body is. If the person is very practical, they know how spiritual the person is. If the person is capable of acting on command performance, you know how liberated they are.
And people were touching and touching, and he was aware of this one woman who touched his garment. Okay. And I know he responded instantly to the situation. Okay. A master cannot say no to divine will.
No.
But all the people around, can they draw and draw and draw and draw until they wear that person out?
No.
Point.
No.
No.
In the first place, you wouldn't know how to draw unless you were dressed. Unless you do what? You put yourself in a boat right there. The woman is sick. She is the one who knows she's sick. The master is sitting over there offering love to all who come, offering blessings and healing to those who come. Not everyone is saying the same thing that this woman is going to say to herself. She is not able to go close up to the master to ask, because everybody is pushing to be near the master. She is making this mental alignment by saying, if I but touch the hem of his garment, I will be well. Now that takes a lot of conviction and analysis in your mind to make a statement to yourself like that, let alone to go test it. She didn't just go reach out and touch it without talking to herself first. She spoke to herself first, so she set up what? The perimeters for her consciousness to focus. Now, if I would but touch the hem, now you know where the hem is here, you know. Do you feel that? Look. If I would but touch, the words she used, touch, but the hem of his garment, I would be made whole. She decided to sneak up and touch. Now, if the master is in the delta level or the unified field, every garment, every rock, and every skin in that entire community is his consciousness. But people can be touching you without any intent. The mere fact they love you and want to touch you. But she had a specific intent to get well. That's a different connotation in consciousness. So when she touched, was she touching just for the sake of touching him or for the sake of being a recipient for something that you needed?
She's touching him to be a recipient.
Exactly. And therefore, that would automatically release energy from his mechanism for her to fulfill the need. So his remark was very simple. Someone has touched me. He didn't say someone is pushing against me. He said someone has touched me. Now, touch in that sense is far-reaching, more than people who hear the word touch. And Peter jumped up and said, Master, everyone is pushing against or touching me. How can you say that someone? He said, I don't mean that. And he would go on to make a big issue of the word touch. That this is a different kind of involvement. It's an extraction process with intent. The other touch is not with intent. Then he looks around in the crowd and singles out the woman and said, Woman, your faith has made you whole. Then the new who actually touched him from a standpoint of needing than those who were just touching because the crowd was around him. And she got well. That's a distinct interaction at the atomic level of two thought processes to release. Now that woman was not an initiate. She was a woman in need. Yet at the same time, he granted her relief. Ask yourself, if you were in that position, would you ask for initiation right away? After you got the relief? Right. You were what? Initiated without even asking, right? Because you already did what? Set your mind up to be initiated by reaching out to touch him on that level. And if you got the result, you knew that you being granted, he was already granting you initiation.
Wouldn't there be some of the sonics involved there that where he could, as she made this statement, that he perceived that?
Exactly. Because,
Adama, my question is how can a person do that with that kind of intention and draw the grace from the Master and yet fall out of that grace and suffer extreme levels of suffering within themselves?
The person could not come to that decision if they didn't have the pain to suffer before meeting that teacher and tried every means to get well. And remember what kind of sickness she had, that she would ask for such a question or such a healing. Do you realize what type of illness she had? She would suffer from extreme menstruation that didn't stop. That was our sickness, the issue of blood. She was constantly menstruating, it can't stop. There were no cure in those days to stop hemorrhaging of the body. Issue of blood, they used to call it. And she felt the need for the resolve because the doctors around couldn't do it. So her intensity was so great because her lifeblood is going out of her body. So what could be more intense than to be relieved and believe and be initiated all at one time? She wanted all at one time, so that's why she came to this particular awakening. Her own higher consciousness made her conscious to think in those terms, to reach out for initiation. She couldn't walk up and say, Master, initiate me. Because what would have happened, the 12 disciples that we had chosen would feel what? Jealous, because you'd be initiating her out of context. Yet Jesus initiated many people that were not of the 12 and helped them on many levels to be household initiates. And she was being healed and initiated all at one time. That was her great grace. She wanted it and she got it. Now the thing is if the need is so great and you reach out, it happened. That's the grace. Given their story, Yogananda was arriving in his place in California one day, and he got out of a brand new Cadillac. And some people were waiting for him. There were close about 32 people. And there was a man who was from England, never met Yogananda, he didn't know who Yogananda was. But there he's standing, but he's familiar with Swamis. And he's surprised to see this Swami getting out of a brand new Cadillac. So he's saying to his mind, if this man is a Swami, what is he driving in a Cadillac for? He should be begging bowl and all that kind of attitude. Yogananda turns around. They're not introduced. And it's the first time they're meeting, they're waiting for him to come in to a lecture. And he looks straight to the man, he says, Mr. Johnson. Now you can imagine how that man felt. Not being introduced and his name is being called up right there in the public. I did not ask for this Cadillac. It was given to me. In fact, it's a very poor expression of man's creativity, looking forward to a better model next year. I walked in the room. So when he said that, and I got that letter of what somebody copied all the notes and sent me what Yogananda said about this thing, I said, that's the right attitude an initiate should have, looking forward to a better model next year. Why limit God? But why try to perform miracles when you're entitled to better models next year? And this is your option in the world of abundant living. I have come that you may have life more abundantly, but we don't know how to apply it, so we feel threatened, we feel left out. It's when we understand what is, then we can apply it without looking for the magic of it. So when that man thought Yogananda had no right to drive in a Cadillac, and he thought that Swami should be having begging bowls, that was his version of what he thought God realized men supposed to be. When Yogananda is trying to show him that God realization has nothing to do with functioning with the abundance of life. He wasn't looking forward to have the car as a possession. He wasn't attached to it. He made the man realize it in a very simple way. Mr. Johnson, I did not ask for this car. It was given. And in fact, it's a poor expression of man's creativity. Meaning, you're not looking at the highest possibility of man's qualities yet. You're looking at his present state of evolution, looking forward to a better model. I'm looking forward to more and more greater inventions allowed by the creative consciousness to work through my human brothers. And that's what he's telling the man, you are limiting creativity. When creativity is here to what? To be experienced, appreciated, but not possessed. And that's the difference. Why the Buddha says attachment is the cause of suffering. He didn't say desire is the cause of suffering. You have a right to desire. God desired to build a world. Why should he not? But is he attached to it? That's the question. Since he can't close it down before midnight eternity, and he ain't got no competitors, he's not attached. He's totally free, you see. That's what we have to realize, the difference between desire as a principle to which we have the right to use, attachment as a fixation from the fear that we will never get more is not valid. It breaks you down. Attachment is living to die. Desire to use and expand and express better and better is living to live. You see it? And that's the healthy attitude. So whatever you desire, it is valid for you to experience it. But don't get locked into the attitude that you can't get more, no more is going to happen, and this is all there is. and then you automatically shut off. So, I used to be like that before, years ago, until I saw Yogananda making these comments, and then when I applied it and see it work, I realized I have the technique to resolve all my past karmic conditions and not to generate future ones. Then therefore what I desire in terms of using and not being attached was a valid process of living life abundant. And you're entitled to it. So don't feel threatened, and it's not a matter of showing off. It's a matter of appreciating the position you're in and what you actually are, how best you can serve in your environment. Use it. Now you can laugh. Great. You had a question to ask me, man.
I was thought about when I was doing my meditation. Mm-hmm. The first few days, it was full exhale and inhalation. And about the fifth day, the sixth day, something like that, I started coughing. Mm-hmm. And was coughing more and more and more. Finally, I had to quit it. And I've been coughing more since. And I've been working it out. I can breathe now, and mm-hmm. it's not as much. It's coming. It's working itself out, but it's taken time.
Somewhere in a past incarnation, you might have had some pulmonary illness that you might have phased out of your body and never resolved it, and therefore the karmic condition that led up to it is locked into the DNAs and the helix of the spinal column and in the endocrine system. And so those are residual past life patterns to be resolved as you do the technique of phasing it out. The condition has to come to the surface as a cleansing process. The technique is a biological cleaning process to deactivate the body from decomposition to corrective control and continuation of life. But it can't do that till you clean it. So the cleaning out is the phasing out of mucus and all those different patterns that are kept in there. So if you had a pulmonary condition in a past life, a lot of things that you held in traumatically are locked in into those frequencies, and as you start working it out, they're going to start phasing out. You'll find, I went through that coughing spell for a while, then when I did have a regression of a past life, I saw I did die of pneumonia in one life, and I did die of extreme chest congestions. So in my early youth, I did have a lot of problems too with it. And so as I worked with the Kriya technique more and more, I started phasing out, the body started to clean up. And then I was able to overcome the dryness and the coughing sensation, and the body was becoming back normal. But you have to go through it and resolve it, because it's a own natural self-cleaning process. So it's nothing to be afraid of, but it's a matter of just going through it till it resolves itself. Other people get some different symptoms. I know of some people who get extreme runny nose when they do it. Others get dryness, the tongue gets very dry. Others get a lot of burping. But these are all residual conditions of past life traumas that are being phased out by the technique. Some people get a tremendous urge to go to the bathroom. When you bring the bread up, you're only holding it for the count of 10, mm-hmm. and don't stay there and hold it long. Then you go back down and hold it for the count of 10. So the idea is that there's a pause between the coming up and going down. So when you come up, then you count 10 and pause, go down, come, see. But that is a pause rhythm.
I've not had problems with it really, but when I first started, holding the breath and the inhalation is no problem because I'm doing this forever, but on the exhalation, very difficult at first, especially still shaking and everywhere off, but I just wondered what that would be indicative of.
This is very, very normal. But when you pull the breath out, you may quiver. And nothing to worry about in some people, pulling it out does trigger the kinesis of the energy to move back up. So the point is not to panic. It's just that you will have certain sensations of going up or going down. Whichever direction it takes to manifest in you, that's where the karmic patterns are locked in. If your body is quivering on the downward movement, then there are suppressions in the lower centers of the body. If the conditions are quivering when you're coming up, then the suppressions are in the upper part of the spinal cord. So you have the different, put it this way, the midpoint is the heart. See? And quivering below the heart is the downward pressures that are stored up there from many past life traumas. Then quivering above the heart is traumas that are stored up in the past. So each one has its own, but the heart is the midpoint. I don't know if you ever saw Fantasia. Fantasia, when all the spirits were going to the Netherlands at night, up in the mountains, in the darkness, and then just before dawn, this big bell rang. The angelus was playing, and they saw this big heart and a door, and all the souls kept coming back to. That's the basic midpoint. In the parable of the two brothers, the prodigal son, the father is meeting the son at the halfway mark. Creative consciousness meets the ego of the heart. It doesn't go below the heart to meet you. It will not pull you out from your egotistical drive. Intuitive consciousness will not pull you out from the egotistical drive below the heart. It will greet you at the heart to expand it, to have compassion and move upwards. So in other words, you have to make your own roundabout turn from falling down from the heart to the toxic area of what we call fixation. See, as you descend down the heart, down to the navel, you lose the compassion, then you become big guts. You can't do nothing wrong, you don't want to. Then when that gets out of focus, then you get to the next level, you become very vulgar. You think that the whole world owes you everything. And then last but not least, you go right down to the anus, where, well, hell with it, you'd rather kill than be. See what I mean? You get very, very dogmatic. And that's where the ego has to make a turn around now, come back from the dogmatic bullheadedness right up through the to the heart and start the compassionate. So it works its way back up. You see, at the navel, you're undecided if you should go up or go down back. And in the genital organs, you don't give a damn what happened. And the anus is do or die. So here you have the fixations. But once you get back to the heart, which is the midpoint of the compassionate nature, then you pulls up now to listening to divine will in the throat. Not your will, but divine will. Then as you start surrendering to divine will, you pull back up into the forehead for the correct focus of the inner alignment of your nature, which is seeing truth instead of seeing at life. Those who have eyes to see, let them see. Those that have ears to hear, let them hear. This point now becomes more and more centered. So you are no longer deluded. Then last but not least, you go up into the top center for the stepping out into the liberated consciousness to merge with the divinity. So, but you have to work back. Now, the prodigal son is met by the creative consciousness of the heart. The other brother is going to come in to argue. He's right there between the throat and the forehead. He's been home all the time. He never did nothing wrong. So why is this other portion of the body getting preference? See? But then the creative consciousness says, you are here, you never invited me. You understand? the me is up here. This will never ask us to come down and share or open up any other consciousness. But your brother who has gone all the way down with his big ego is coming back. All I'm going to do for him is give him a center of focus to come back up. I'm not placing him ahead of you. You've been here and you have maintained your discipline. So for that reason, love him as a brother. In other words, the tongue should respect the heart. Even though the tongue has the right to tell the heart off, that you did let down and you mucked up, you know what I mean? But that's the process inside it. You pull your consciousness up from the coccyx muscle or center up through the sacrum, up through the lumbar, back to the heart to get a sense of focus. And then you work your way from there to will in control, sense of direction, or intuitive awareness. But in between there is the mouth. Who likes to chastise, you see? So you don't have a right to come back here and assume your position. But this consciousness regulates this one. So eventually this pulls back. And then you go from here to here in the true relationship. So both brothers do end up going back inside. You're both nature, left brain, right brain, both we center back in the center, and then the journey back. Free men are allowed, as you said. Yeah?
You just kind of stepped on what I was going to ask you. As far as the chanting is concerned, when you start the meditation, you go through the spinal cord. I was wondering if you could just explain, starting from the cycle of on the way up, and which regions stand for what function?
All right. Om coccyx. The word Om is the cosmic sonics that incorporates the three movements of the mouth. The open mouth is oh, or ah, eh. And projected mouth is oo, you, a, you. The lips pull back at m. So the word is aum. But we don't say aum. We can't move the mouth in any three other movements other than see the three movements?
Mm-hmm.
Just like the eyes are. That's the three movements of the eyes. They match the three movements of the mouth. Close, open, half open. The mouth is the same. Full open is ah, forward is oo, you, and the lips folded is m. But it's in tone as om or shalom. The ksh is the guttural and nasal connotation. That's where the word, in some countries they use the word shalom instead of om, meaning peace. Om means peace, see? Om, om. But then it's the sonics that is surrounding you, that is permeating the whole environment. So the ancient man recognized that this sonics is surrounding him stereophonically, and he can hear it as the vibratory motor of a car or the vibratory motor of the universe. And if you want to hear it very distinctly, go at an airport or any mechanical room, you'll hear it. So it's called the cosmic motor hum. Your own body is a motor. It's making that same biological humming. Yet it's synchronized to seven locations in the body as shunts. So your first shunt for the pressure of that resonance is the base of the spine, which is called the anal or coccyx. Now, at that location, all the crystalline forces of the body in the 144 elements are forced to phase out there. So imagine Mr. Ford trying to make a car without any exhaust pipe. He'd be stuck, right? So he couldn't make a car without an exhaust because he copied God. God can't make a human being without a buttocks. Right, that's the exhaust for the gas. So you see, now, it may sound mundane, but let's look at it in terms of internal physics. What is it doing? Every time you phase out your karmic patterns, you have two gases to contend with. Oxygen to rebuild and clean up, and carbon dioxide to go out as an indicator that the waste product, the committed condition, is resolved. So the downward thrust is the deoxidation, and the extra atoms from inhalation are retained now for transformation and rebuilding. So you have to have a structural outlet. So the coccyx is that structural outlet. So nature pumps it out through that area, the heat. So we call it a heat discharge. So when you do the Kriya breathing, where is the coal going? To your anus or to your pineal? To the pineal. And the heat is going from the pineal to the anus, right? So you see a natural hydraulic and a natural discharge process set up for the phasing out of the misapplied sonics brought on by previous pressures in your previous lives, and they have to work their way out naturally by natural chemistry out through an outlet. So the anus is a discharge area. So that is where the first movement of the energy is releasing. So it's an Om Coccyx, identifying it as a code or identifying it as a point of reference that you recognize where this energy is going out in your own anatomy by being specific with. And not just, you can use the oriental terms, but remember, we're speaking English, and therefore the English understanding makes it a little more intimate. Unless you're trained in an oriental language, then the intimacy would be different. English would not be as intimate as your own personal language. The sense of intimacy is the criteria of being more devoted. So whatever language you're born in, that's where the sense of intimacy is. In today's evolution, of all the languages that break us free from guilt and give us a quicker sense of commitment is English, because it's a combination of a dialect and a language process. So the translation is, I am God. I am automatically gives you a sense of more personalness. I and the Father are one. These are a little more intimate feelings than if you were using another language that didn't generate that feeling. But if you're born in that other language and you were repeating that same concept in that language, you would feel that intimacy. Do you follow me so far? Good. So for that reason, the wise men became more conscious of the anatomy and its chemistry and its physics, and then allow the intellect to generate its intimacy from the language structure that they were born into. This is the individuality, you see. So whatever you are born into, your sense of intimacy is there. Now, the coccyx is the one that Yogananda used because he came to the West. He was chosen to teach the Western men. So he used the Western terms and did not use the Sanskrit term unless he was speaking to people of India. He would sing the Sanskrit song. But over here, he sang it as Om Coccyx, identifying the location anatomically, and therefore you know where you are. Focus, you're in the focus in the coccyx area. Then he said Om Sacrum. That gives the identification and the location. Then he said Om Lumbar. That automatically set up. But then you look at your spine, you'll see you have a coccyx. These are vertebrae. And then you have a sacrum. And you have a lumbar. And then the next level up is Om Thoracic. Or some people say Om Dorsal. But with modern science going more to thoracic instead of dorsal, we say Om Thoracic, just from this range of the body. So that's the fourth range up to the throat, Om Thoracic. Then when he gets to the throat now, he says Om Cervical. It's because that range is here. Now, then we go from the cervical to the pituitary, and that is also known as the third eye or praesentum. So instead of saying pituitary, he says Christ, meaning the integrated relationship with God at the ascended point of reference, at the point between the eyebrow. So they call it the third eye, and so the Indian man would paint a little spot to remind him that this is his biological two-way radio with God. You know, you got to punch in your button, then talk. But imagine when you punch in your button and the bell rings on the other side, and you hang up before the other guy answers, what would happen? And that's what we usually do when we meditate. We punch in our button, the bell rings on the other side, and before God can get out of his bed to answer, you hang up. That's happened many times. And so people say, oh, I get no, I don't know why I'm meditating. And I tell you, you don't wait till God answers the phone. You hang up before. But you, nobody's fault is your own fault. You got to punch in the button. You got the five names as the button. That's what you're punching in. And when the bell rings in there, that's the audible sound. You go, boom, those sounds go on in you. Then you know, and you have the sound of the bee, the sound of a flute. This is how the bell is ringing on the inside to wake up God. And the sound of the harp, and the sound of the bells, the thunderclap, the flash of lightning, and the bagpipe in the highlands. Until you hear these songs registering, he's not going to answer you yet. That's to tell you he's at home. But when he comes in to answer you, when those songs go off, whatever one he wherever he answers you from, he's going to answer you either in three ways. A picture, from the which is stored in the pineal, to indicate his presence. And you've got to be certain that it's him. So you want a whole picture, not a half a picture. From head to foot, totally there. So don't stop testing it. Then that gives you clearance. And if it speaks to you, it doesn't speak through the mouth. It's always through the eyes, like an impression process. That's the second. And the third is, if you're in doubt that he isn't there, or that particular manifestation of God is not there, he's going to ask you for a cup of tea or a piece of bread, just to prove that you're not hallucinating. And when you eat a piece of it and leave it with you, you can guarantee the rest don't rot. Then you know he visited you, and your phone call went through. That's what you're working for. So don't quit until you get sufficient evidence of the creative presence of the liberated soul. Because we're all brothers in it. And he personally is not going to come to this guy and sit down and talk with you. But he will manifest in various individualities like Buddha, Moses, or Muhammad, or Zoroaster. Any one of these men that are in that will give you sufficient tangible evidence of that power to satisfy you once and for all, to let you know you're in a cosmic brotherhood, that you have the same thing, and it's up to you to accept it. Do you follow? So don't... It's not a kind of a process where you're looking for magical things. You're looking for validation of the true actualness of yourself, so that you don't live with the illusions of believing. We have believed for many, many incarnations. It's time we start knowing who we are instead of believing what we are. And all these men came for that one purpose: to break through from the belief to the knowing, and to help us. And they have no other intention than to help us know who we actually are. But this is the part in the head, in the pineal area. So they use the word om to integrate it, and then you identify. So it's more like a conversation and a validation. And tomorrow, we're having the validation in way back in hundreds of years ago, when a fellow like Thomas didn't believe his teacher was the back of the body. He thought he was still a ghost or something. And then the teacher gives him sufficient evidence that he is actually in the realm, but he's not interfering, then Thomas is satisfied. Yogananda was the same. He wasn't satisfied until his teacher proved to him that they are there. I had to be the same too. I couldn't accept either. I had to have something tangible to validate I am actually this love. So I'm looking forward that when you get the experience, you are satisfied, and it's not imagination. But you have what you call safeguards, so that you test it and not get fooled by it. That's the difference that was not left years ago in the ancient writings, and was only given by the teacher to the student, or handed down. What are the safety factors to test it, so that you aren't fooled? One is, yeah?
Can I be seated? Seated, or will they be standing?
No, no, no. They have to be standing. All 5 points. That's why I only teach you one yoga. It's called Mahayoga. I don't have no other form of yoga to teach nobody. Stand on your own 2 feet. That's what they're telling me to. Both feet, 2 hands, head, 5-pointed star of the 5 elements of the universe. The 2 triangles interacting is the polarity, which is called the 6-pointed star. That the polarity goes down and goes up. So Star of David is that particular qualitative design for the Hebrew people. But it's the same 5-pointed star of sonics, temperature, gas, liquid, crystalline that makes the universe. And the realized man is the epitome of these forces in the 5 points, like a dove. But you have to see all 5. If you don't see all 5, it's still in the level of illusion. So don't stop testing. That's why you have the 5 names to repeat, because you want to see the 5 aspects of the creative process. They're distinctly, as I said, even if you see me, don't take it till you see what is actually there. We are all in there for our own validation. So don't quit until you see it. And don't panic, because there's nothing to panic about. Dracula can't bite you, he only bites the actor on the stage. Inside, all language disappear, and the experience is intimacy with the masters who achieved it. And they don't have any language to talk. They have what is called dynamic impression of consciousness through their eyes. So they speak every language and every degree of intimacy to the individual, to show that God is his own creation and is intimate in any degree, in any shape of individuality he takes. See what I mean? We have to go through the process of looking in. We have to go through the process of relating to a language. But when you get into the Delta level, there is no distinction anymore. All is one. Because language disappears, ethnic group or individuality disappears, and the commonality of the experience is impressed upon you. In fact, you can be surprised your friends by coming out talking their language, and they'll kind of freak out too. That's why they say talking in tongues, you see, because all information is impressed on them. So it's not a matter of worrying how intimate you'll be. You start off having a sense of intimacy from the knowledge you're trained in, but as you get deeper inside, that begins to disappear, and a greater sense of intimacy comes on, because you begin to know intuitively. You can look at a person and not even know what language they're speaking and have an intimacy of communication with them, and that's the bond. Because it's what they call the holistic process. That's why Jesus said, I go to the Father, but I send the Holy Spirit, who will remind you of all these things in my name, who will comfort you. This principle comforts you to know that that you don't have to know all the languages in the world, but the sense of intimacy is open from within, and the intuitive communication is impressed upon your consciousness that you can read and know. And therefore, you would, that degree of intimacy is valid. It has nothing to do now with a language, or it has nothing to do with an ethnic group. It has to do with a unified principle that God is love. And when you're feeling it, you don't have language to talk, because you're like this, agape, agape, you know, not erotic. See, love is in Greek is called eros and agape. Well, eros is describing how much you love God, and agape is telling you, I am love, so much there is. See, then the agape is the love itself, and eros is the description of what it is. So one is an individualistic condition, one is the actual condition. But when you enter into it, it doesn't matter what language you come from or background, all these start to diminish into a oneness and a different sense of intensity. So it's called ecstasy. See, now, in Oriental language, they call it anandam. And last night when we were sitting down for an hour, could you describe the hour that went so fast? Good. It's like that, but you see, without the exposure to it, you would not understand what the thing is involving. You see, because time stands still, intellect stands still, intimacy doesn't seem to work. Intimacy leaves you looking to explain to yourself what happened. That's what the intimacy does. It leaves you wanting to explain yourself, or explain to yourself what really took place in that hour. Why did it seem so short, and yet when you look at the clock, it was exactly an hour. That is what intimacy or bliss does to you. You are blissed out, cosmically, biologically drunk by your own spinal alcohol.
What is biologically or physically happening in the body?
Your spinal column is containing 0.5% alcohol, and therefore God has already made sure that you're going to be a biological drunk without having to have the residue of alcoholism in you. Drunk with the spirit, they call it. You see, in the spine, the spinal fluid contains pure ethyl alcohol, and therefore it can't freeze. And by the filtration process, you are making alcohol out of the 144 elements, but that's the purest alcohol. That's the wine that Jesus made at the marriage ceremonies, when everybody else was drinking the other kind of wine. He made cosmic wine out of his own consciousness. You have this principle locked up in you, and that if you take and drink alcohol, you'll feel the same way. You don't know where the time went. You feel stupid when you come out of it, but you have a residual condition from alcohol. Whereas in the biological process involving oxygen and involving internal observation, you don't have a residual or a toxic condition remaining you. Your body does pass through all the levels of an alcoholic feeling and go to a level of suspension.